11/19/69. 2:30 p.m., room 321, State Capitol Building. Today's subject, general definitions.
Meeting will come to order. We'll welcome our newest member, Representative Graham, and welcome him with the admonition that from henceforth this subcommittee is going to meet with regularity every 3 weeks from here on out, and it's a requirement that we all attend every meeting.
Do we have anything to talk about?
Right. Now, I don't have an agenda, but I assume the first thing would be the minutes of the meeting of December 18th, and are there any corrections or additions to these minutes? Anybody see any besides me? Let me then direct the committee's attention to page 8.
Page 8?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I have lost without these, or at least
you have them, I suspect, somewhere.
Yeah, they'll be in your book there.
And Bruce, first full paragraph, second sentence. You had the floor, and it said, Mr. Spaulding thought it was not improper to use material element in a sense different from that historical concept, et cetera, et cetera. Take a moment to look at that in context and advise us whether or not...
Well, let's see, what is it referring to?
I think there's a typographical error here, but maybe there isn't. We're talking about elements of a crime, and we were referring to subsection 3. And we were talking about on the tip of my tongue last night.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I think they've got it just backwards, but I can't remember exactly.
Okay. Well, we discussed this phrase element of the crime, or material element, and we had discussed the question as to whether or not how it related to attendant circumstances, and I think there was a further discussion the term material element had a fixed meaning in the law, and that this meaning was not what was intended by that phrase that's used in this draft. And now, with respect to this particular paragraph on page 8, the clerk asked me about this at the time she was transcribing the minutes, and it was my recollection that your statement that was to the effect that you didn't think it was improper to use material element in a sense different from the historical concept, but that because it was employed in a certain way in the draft.
Well, this is, I thought, thought it was nothing.
Yeah. Well, and I just wondered if that was in fact a statement or if it was a typographical error, because here we're talking about historical concept would have been the material element, the conduct, but here we're extending that to include attendant circumstances and result of conduct. And I guess if the minutes are correctly reflect your view, you're saying that there's nothing wrong with extending this beyond its historical concept. Is this right, Don?
Well, that was my understanding of what Mr. Spaulding had said at the meeting, but...
Hasn't the historical concept included in the past attendant circumstances, though?
No, subsection 3 of what did it refer to?
Well, all right.
Subsection 3 of...
This is... preliminary draft number 1.
Preliminary draft number 1, culpability.
Oh, I remember.
Next to the last, next to the last.
It's sub 2 of section 2. Thing, right, Tom?
Yeah.
Well, or sub 1, actually. For conduct, no, sub 2.
Sub 2 of section 2.
Well, actually, it comes up in section
1. Comes up in section 1.
Section 1, last right clause.
General purposes of the provision of this code are?
Well,
last half of section 1. I think there's a lot of things going to change.
Oh, yeah. This is correctly stated.
It is correctly stated?
I think so.
All right. Well, then with that in mind, there aren't any other corrections or additions to the minutes, we'll approve them without reading them. There's no objection. And at the last subcommittee meeting, we went over these general principles of liability and culpability, and as you'll see, we amended, see from the minutes, we amended section 1, adopted subs 1 and 2 of section 2 without amendments. Then we kind of got hung up, and we decided that we sent it back to the drawing board, and we had a real problem because Courtney Arthur, who's been on this for a year, was doing the drafting, and he is apparently now charged with the task of redrafting this and hasn't gotten it done in the last 2 months. So I suggested to Don today that our time schedule is such that we just can't afford to wait for him, and that we ought to proceed on our own. However, and with Don doing the drafting, for today's meeting, Don has drafted general definitions. And I propose today to consider these general definitions and then ask Don whether you have something else programmed to follow this or whether you intend to go back to general principles of liability. It's my feeling that having started general principles of liability, we ought to stick with it until we get finished with it.
Well, after the last meeting, in fact, the same day after the subcommittee meeting adjourned, I sat down with Professor Arthur, and we went through generally what the discussion had been with respect to that draft. He wanted to go ahead and redraft it, and I pointed out to him what I felt what changes were needed to meet the suggestions that the subcommittee had made. And with that in mind, I went ahead with work on another section of the same general article, feeling that we should go ahead and, as long as work is being done on this other section anyway, and he had started it, that I would let him go ahead and finish it up, and I'd move ahead with some of these other sections. I think that, and as I told Senator Burns when we discussed this, I talked with Professor Arthur this past week about it, and he has decided to send a poll around to the prosecutors in New York, at least to some of them, the state of New York and the state of Illinois, requesting their comments as to whether or not they've had any problems under their under their culpability statutes. And, of course, this is all well and good, but the problem is that it does hold up progress on this. And I think we all recognize we get to the point where you have to be somewhat arbitrary with some of these drafts.
The problem is that this commission has an existing remainder of its life, about 20 months,
right,
to complete this project, print and circulate the report among interested parties and groups, and get it back, make whatever revisions are necessary, and furnish a completed copy to the next legislative session. This thing is important enough to the total that we can't leave it till the end. It isn't like deciding, well, we can worry about arson last or something else. We're in the gut issue of the thing. I think we're going to have to move. I don't know whether whether Courtney's in a position to realize that and have time back on it, do it, or whether we're going to have to get other help, or whether Don's going to have to do it, or what. I don't think we can wait for Courtney to design a questionnaire and find out who the prosecuting attorney of Dutchess County, New York is, and send it to him, and then wait 2 months and then call him up and say, hey, fill out that questionnaire later, get it back, and, you know, we're talking about a 6-month project.
Well, you've hit the point right on the head, and honestly, I think the subcommittee has performed marvelously, but I think our effectiveness depends upon our ability to meet regularly at short intervals. The probate revision committee met every third Saturday for 2 years, plus the preceding Friday, and we've got one complete new subcommittee almost, and another new subcommittee chairman, and we're operating pretty much with the old personnel. So if you don't mind, I'll draft a letter to Professor Arthur advising him that it's the sense of the committee that we have to move, and that try to be as diplomatic as I can, and suggest in rather polite terms that Don's going to take over the primary responsibility for drafting these articles and program our schedule so that the next meeting that we have, we go to the second draft on general principles of liability. Do you have any objection at all?
No.
You might. I suppose you might want to discuss this with the chairman. I don't know.
Oh, I will.
You know, because those assignments, those early assignments that were made, and these preliminary articles were made before I was retained by the commission, were made back in the first 6 months of the life of this body, and not after last January. I have been a little reluctant to.
Well, you're in a tough position
to jump right
there. Push somebody who's furnishing free service.
That's right.
Right.
I agree with you.
But I won't take anybody's name in vain, but we'll try to handle it that way. Before we get into general.
I think we've got to shoot to meet our deadline. We may not make it, but we've got to bust our material to try it.
I think that none of us on this subcommittee particularly wanted to handle general principles of liability as much as some of the other
things. There's some other things we'd like to get to.
But we decided to do it because it was the most important thing at the time. Before we get into this, let me just fill you in on a couple of things that have happened. Don appeared in front of the emergency board, and they approved our budget request in toto without, not the emergency board, but the subcommittee of Ways and Means. And they completely approved our request for the coming biennium. It's coming before the full Ways and Means Committee, but I don't anticipate any problem on that at all. And last week, Cinder Yaturi and I met with the man who was the head of, or the administrator of the Crime Control Coordinating Council, and two people from the Office of Law Enforcement Assistance from Washington, to see if there would be an availability of federal funds to help us through this next biennium so we could get some drafting help. Apparently there's $240,000 of federal money coming in under the Safe Streets bill. It's going to be channeled through the Crime Control Coordinating Council. But they say that none's available to criminal law revision because that is planning money, and we are beyond the planning stage. We're an action group. So we have a couple of contingency requests in, and it's possible that we might get some assistance from them, but I am afraid that it's going to come so darn late that it won't do us any good. And we're probably going to have to rely on the money we're going to get from the legislature and hopefully move as fast as we can ourselves so that we can get as far as we can. Well, Don, let's get into general definitions.
All right, now, I'd like to begin an examination of this draft by pointing out that there are at least two possible ways that you can go on this question of definitions. We could lump all of our definitions together, including the definitions that relate to culpability, as well as the definitions that relate to classes of crimes, and put them all into one big section. Or we can proceed as we have done up to now, although we don't have to be married to this approach by any means, but it seems to me that the approach that whereby we define culpability terms in the section on culpability, and we define terms such as offense and crime and misdemeanor and felony in terms such as that in a separate section on classes of crimes makes more sense and is more understandable when one approaches this code cold. Now, as you can see from the text of these from New York and Michigan, they've done it the other way. Now,
they've done it all definitions one place.
They've put them all under one section. As a matter of fact, it was my feeling that they have, in addition to putting culpability and other definitions in this general section, they have put in some rather specific type definitions that I would think belong in the specific section to which they apply. For example, the definition of juror and public servant. But here again, and these are questions that I felt were questions for the subcommittee to decide. But my approach to this relatively short list of definitions was this, that I felt that the terms that we did put in here should be terms that had general application throughout the code and not just terms that maybe appeared in one or two places only. And also that we not bring over the culpability definitions and the crime definitions into this section. Now, some of the, in fact, all except one, our new definitions. The definition of person under, oh, and I might mention this. Now you'll notice that the draft begins with section 3, and the reason that it's been arbitrarily numbered as section 3 is because under the preliminary article, there have been two other sections that have already been drafted, and this would be designed to fit in to this major preliminary article.
Where are they?
Well, they're in your books, under classes of crimes, for example. Well, that's section 4, but principles of construction, purposes, general purposes of the code was numbered as section 2, and section 1 would be reserved for title to the code.
These were approved, weren't they?
Yes, by Subcommittee 3.
Was that Mahoney Subcommittee? Or?
No, that was Dale Harlan's Subcommittee.
Well, in my law practice, over there, they, you know, the statutes are in the hands of lots of people besides lawyers, and lots of people besides judges and so forth and so on. Every police officer has a copy of them. Deputy Sheriff's got a copy of them. Every newspaper's got a set of the codes and so forth. And even it was impossible under the old OCLA to ever find anything. Under ORS, I could find some things. And I can't decide in my own mind whether it's easier for a guy to look up arson and go to arson and see what arson is defined as and then find out what the crime arson consists of in its various degrees, or whether he should have a section on definitions and go look up arson there, and then have a footnote at the end of it saying, for punishment, see such and such. And you people, which is going to be easier on the user?
Well, I think with respect to definition of crimes, the definition usually is an integral part of the statement of anything about the crime.
Yeah.
And so I would think, as Dunn says, that definitions of crimes, at least on that the definition ought to be included under arson.
Now, it'd be a terrible burden, wouldn't it, to go back then and put the general definitions at the head of each one of the chapters. The chapter on arson, if you've got a chapter on arson. To repeat the general definitions so that the guy who goes to look up arson sees that person means such and such, possessed means such and such.
No, it wouldn't necessarily be a burden, because Fresno ORS definition 161.010 only takes up maybe one full column, one of these small pages, and it could easily be, we're talking here about seven subsections really, and that's all we're talking about today. But I think we asked a policy decision just in answering your question to me, and I think I would say that it would be unnecessary law if the code is set up logically, coherently, and indexed so that chapter one is a section on general definitions. Wouldn't necessarily take a lawyer to go there to look them up.
I don't know, I use the statutes, I think, more than most non-lawyer citizens in this state, and I just get completely lost every once in a while. Even trying to find things in the index, And I know there's a logical system to it, but nobody ever bothered to explain the logic of it to me. And I get that. Look at the blue sky laws one time. And I don't know, I must have spent a half an hour with the index before I could find out where the blue sky laws, where they were. And sometimes it's easier to take the little tab and read every page.
Well, I wonder whether that's true with regard to cadet as with regard to the criminal law.
No. Criminal laws as they're organized now are pretty good for my purpose. When I look up the difference between burglary and robbery, when I can find the definition pretty well hooks near the crime, so that you can find out.
I don't know. It would seem to me that rather than clarifying the code, that if we had a repetition in each subsequent section or each subsequent article of the code of the same general definitions, that might be confusing to a lot of people, and that you might end up wondering whether you should be required to compare what your definitions are with respect to the article on robbery with the, if these general definitions are the same as the one over here, and it would seem to me if we define the general definitions once and make it clear that it's going to apply throughout the code, that except for the specific and necessary definitions with respect to the individual crimes, that I don't know, it would seem to me that repeating them would maybe cause more problems than it would help. But
well, I'm perfectly willing to accept it. I just wanted to raise a question and listen to some discussion.
My thought would be that they should be in a general definitional chapter in the beginning of the criminal code itself, and not be repeated throughout each chapter as a preface to each chapter. Now, I'm not going to interrupt you, Don, but if you've reached a breaking or a logical stopping place, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
We're going to call this here, use my Eastern Oregon colloquialism section, general definitions. But there are some words that need defining generally, such as felony, misdemeanor. Words, for example, that you put at the top of page 2 here, violation, crime. And to take them out of the general definitional section and put them over in classes of crimes seems to me is confusing. And I want you to explain to me, and then also I want you to explain why you think that the way we set it up here is preferable, if you do, and also justify why it's so darn much more abbreviated in scope than even our present 5 of the 7 definitions here relate to injury or weapon.
If it is, it ain't. Well, 161, to answer the last part of your question first, 161.010 deals with definitions that primarily relate to culpability. Willfully, negligence, corruptly, malice, wrongfully, wantonly, knowingly. 1 through 7 of your definitions deal with culpability terms, most of which are going to be replaced by something in the nature of the draft that this subcommittee considered in this last meeting on culpability. It seemed to me these terms logically belong in the section on culpability. And of course, from a practical standpoint, that section had already been drafted, at least a start had been taken on drafting that section. And rather than change horses in the middle of the stream and pull those definitions out that had been placed in that section on culpability, I left them there. Both those reasons, because I felt they logically belong there, and secondly, they'd already been drafted with that in mind by Professor Arthur. And the same way with the same thing can be said to almost the same degree with respect to classes of crimes. That the preliminary draft number 2. But at the same time, as I said at the very beginning of the meeting, this is somewhat arbitrary. I think you could go either way on it. And I don't think that in the long run, so long as they're defined someplace in the code, it's not going to make that much difference, probably.
Well, I think if you're going to go the definition route, it's going to simplify a lot of things if you put definitions where you define the definitions. I think that you're going to have a definition of a person or a weapon that it doesn't do harm to you to also include in the same general section line, immediately following section line, in the same place anyway when you compile it, the definition of misdemeanor, felony, degrees, felonies, if you, whatever defining you have to do on it. You don't have to define degrees, but misdemeanor or felony, what a crime is. It seems to me it would be as useful to the person using the book as to also find out that a person means a corporation, an unincorporated association, a partnership.
Well, in the Model Penal Code on page 22, it has 16 definitions, starting with statute. It defines statute, act, voluntary, omission, conduct, actor, acted, person, element of offense, material element of offense, purposely, intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, negligently, and reasonable belief. Then you slip over the page, and then having defined knowingly, reckless, or recklessly, negligently, they go to general requirements of culpability, and they define a person acts purposely with respect to a material element of an offense when a person acts knowingly when with respect to a material element of offense. The same for recklessly and the same for negligently. But notwithstanding the fact that they talk about recklessly, negligently, knowingly, purposely in the culpability section, they also have defined the definitional section.
Then follow that with weapon, and dangerous weapon, and deadly weapon. And
but they don't put in there. They don't put in there the terms that relate to classes of crimes.
No, nor do they put in anything in there about deadly weapon. I think our meeting today, probably more than anything, is going to be a policy meeting to decide which way we're going to go. Because Don needs some direction. We haven't talked to him about it. But, so I like, what do you think, Bruce?
Well, I would think, as I said a while ago, that all the definitions except what constitutes a particular crime ought to go in general definition.
You mean weapon, deadly weapon, dangerous weapon, along with knowingly, recklessly, mm-hmm. so forth and so on, along with person and injury and physical injury and so forth and so on.
And crime, misdemeanor.
All those things one place, and then keep in the other place with the individual crimes themselves a definition of arson and
what kind
robbery
of
and burglary and so forth.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
I'm just listening today.
Don?
You may lose your book forever on that system.
Do you, does it do any violence to the projected format? And of course, any projected format is subject to change, but with doing violence to it as it relates to classes of crime, to put in misdemeanor and felony crime and violation in here. Are we talking about apples and oranges really? Because in the section on classes of crime, we're going to define not what a felony is, but the application of the definition to the various sections we've drawn. Is that right?
Well,
what is it?
Well, now our draft that was approved in by Subcommittee 3 which is preliminary draft number 2, dated August of 68, sets out, number 1, it says an offense defined by any statute of this state for which a sentence of imprisonment is authorized is a crime. Crimes are classified as felonies, misdemeanors, and petty misdemeanors. Then it goes on to say what a felony is, what a misdemeanor is, what a petty misdemeanor is, what an offense, or what a violation is, rather, and then goes into some other provisions with respect to the nature of the punishment for these respective crimes. So it not only defines in the terms that are employed, but it also provides for a certain amount of disposition of the offenders and action that would be taken subsequent to conviction by the court. Certainly with respect to classes of crimes, those definitions at this stage of the drafting process could be easily moved over and put into this section without doing any particular violence to what we're trying to accomplish. But I'm not so sure that you can say the same thing about the culpability definitions, because they're in somewhat of a state of flux at this stage. We're not even sure what terms we're going to. We're not even sure what terms we're going to employ, and it seemed to me that since we'd already segregated these, that we could move ahead on one, that being the general definitions provisions. Classes of crimes has already been approved by the subcommittee, and then we could consider culpability separately. Could be that another way to approach it would be to go ahead with the way we have it now, and then lump them all together after each of these individual sections has been approved at the commission level.
We could do that easily enough. I think at the same time we're going to have to decide what our intent is, just so we have some idea of direction which we're moving.
Well, we could have, like, for example, chapter 1, general provisions, and then just follow the model penal code format. Chapter 1, general provisions, section 101, definition. Define the however many things that we're going to define, and then section 102, classes of crimes, section 103, general principles of construction, section 104, general principles of liability or
culpability.
Viability, and we have the whole thing within the same chapter, and they're there. Now, is this what you projected, Don?
Well, yes.
I had the impression, it may have been a mistaken impression, that we were talking about a different chapter.
Oh, no, these would all be under one major chapter. These would be separate sections. As the model penal code sets out, Article 1, which is preliminary, then is broken down into a number of separate sections which deal with the general definitions and classes of crimes and jurisdiction and a number of other provisions. But you see, from a drafting standpoint, these early articles are particularly troublesome. Professor Arthur, when he began working in this area, when he came to classes of crimes, for example, it was his judgment and his recommendation to the subcommittee that we follow the approach that was generally taken by the model penal code. But then when he came to the...
When he came to write, he followed the California.
Well, no, when he came to the section, the section on culpability, he followed California, you see. So California approached it by defining the culpability terms in a separate section, whereas the model penal code doesn't. The model penal code does, though, define the classes of crimes definitions in a separate section. So I can appreciate the problems that Professor Arthur would have reconciling these things so that although the Commission generally felt that we should follow the format of the Model Penal Code, if we're going to depart, as if when we feel it's reasonable and wise to do so from the Model Penal Code, and look to some of these other states, and we're bound to have some differences in structure. I don't think they're critical, however, to the overall effectiveness of the code. I think that it's and certainly from a drafting standpoint, where we have more than one person drafting, that the approach that we have taken so far, I think, facilitates the drafting job for the individual reporter, because he can then concern himself with this one specific section, as I did on definitions. But at the same time, for example, Section 2 and Section 3 could later be combined into one section on definitions if you wanted to do it that way. But
my personal preference is to lump them as close together as we possibly can for purposes of coherence.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that's
the same too.
If we're gonna lump some, let's lump everything excepting the definition of arson, for example. We get everything in one place or else nothing in one place.
Okay, well now with that as a general policy declaration of the committee to give you as something of kind of a guideline, what I would like to do is, and see if you agree, is to go through the seven definitions that we have here on page one of this draft and to discuss them from a substantive standpoint, throw it around and see whether we think that they're adequately defined. And then talk about the other definitions that appear in the Model Penal Code and also in ORS 161010, and to make a judgment as to which of these should also be included, because they pervade the entire criminal code and I think belong in the general definition section. And is that acceptable way
mm-hmm.
to go? Before we start, how many would like to have coffee?
I would.
Hey, Maxine, could you, you've met everybody. You've met everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Could you call the Sergeant Arms in the Senate and tell him you're calling for me and ask him to see if we can't get a page to get a pot of coffee and five or six cups out of the Senate lounge and bring it up here? Is black okay?
Pretty bad.
Maybe Cecil Edwards, that would be the best. Call Cecil, you know him. Okay, Don.
What's Cecil's job?
He's the Secretary of the Senate.
Is he?
You probably know him from...
Oh, I've known him forever, yeah.
Forever and ever?
Yeah.
He is the...
I knew Cecil when he was in the remount service.
In the Racing Commission?
Oh, before that, he was in the remount service. Army remount.
The Mule Corps.
Well, the pick the saddle horses for the cavalry.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's not too many people that know what that is. I didn't until later.
That's about everybody in Eastern Oregon.
As a matter of fact, I was supposed to say hello to you for Cecil. I had dinner with him the other
day. Yeah.
Talking about Bob Motz. I guess he knows Bob
well. Yeah, but I knew Cecil and I knew each other real well when we were good little kids. Quite a lot of contact with each other.
Cecil's particularly well known in Arabian breeders' circles up now before he got involved with the Racing Commission.
I saw him out in the hall one day. I saw him out in the hall at the courthouse one day when I was trying a case about a horse that was supposed to have been a vicious horse and hurt the plaintiff. And call him in as a witness just on that much notice, and he did a beautiful job. Told all about the proclivities of that particular horse, or kind of a horse. Oh, no.
He's one of the state's most knowledgeable horsemen.
Yeah.
He is. He's an exceptionally good judge.
Mm-hmm.
You can put him in any class, hunters and jumpers, or stock horses, or saddlebreds, or ponies to a cart, mm-hmm. or anything else, and Cecil can stand up there and do better than most judges can who specialize in judging that class.
Well, he sure did a good great job of being an expert witness on that horse. I didn't have any idea. And I gave him $50 and he thought it was overpaid.
He's got a great eye for action. You know, that horse is forging, you know, and you begin to look and check his shoes and you find, sure enough, his back shoe has clipped his front shoe two or three times. You can't hear it or anything else.
Exactly. Well, he sure makes the Senate tick, I'll say that. Sure knows what's going on every minute. Boy, okay.
Well, do you want to just go through these one by one?
Could you tell me where we are in this book?
We're on this
book with
you? Oh, this book, we're in the back section. We're in the back. The
definition.
On about the fourth or fifth page from the end.
Here's.
No, minutes. Should follow the minutes, doesn't it? No, it doesn't follow.
In line, it's in the front.
Yeah, I bet you're right now. I'll have a few minutes.
Yeah. Okay. You're gonna start off with person, eh?
Yes. All right. Person means a human being, and where appropriate, a public or private corporation, an unincorporated association, a partnership, a government, or a governmental instrumentality. Now, that compares with, as I've set out on page 2, the existing law, in ORS 16101 sub 11, now defines person as follows. Person includes corporations as well as natural persons. Where person is used to designate the party whose property may be the subject of a crime, it includes this state, any other state, government, or country which may lawfully own any property in this state, and all municipal, public, or private corporations, as well as individuals. Now, the key language under this one, and this language is taken from the New York Revised Penal Law, Section 10, would leave it up to the court in the instances where it was deemed appropriate to apply. In other words, if it was a question of ownership of property, then the court could apply a person as used in the statute to include a corporation as it does now, for example, and if appropriate, certainly it would seem that in most cases it would be deemed appropriate, we're talking about ownership of property, to apply it to these other entities.
If it would apply to the commission of a crime?
Well,
like a partnership committing a crime.
Yeah, there I don't think it would be held to be appropriate.
Is a trust a public or a private corporation?
A trust?
Yeah. Is it an unincorporated association?
Well, no, not a trust in itself, isn't any entity.
Well, suppose somebody wants to steal something from me, and I have my property in a family trust.
And you're the trustee?
No, somebody else is stealing from me. A person is stealing, by this definition, is stealing from a trust. Is this definition going to apply to those against whom the crime is committed, as well as the person who's committing the crime?
It's directed at the actor.
It basically
primarily.
It won't be used. We're not going to be using it to. I guess in the other case, we'd be referring to the property itself, wouldn't we?
Right.
Rather than owner of, say. All right, I see where I was.
But what you're getting at is, yeah. Well, I think the applicability would be whether or not a trust could be the criminal, so to speak, and If so, would the definition of person fit it? And I would think not.
You'd be after the trustee anyway. Wouldn't trust himself, can't be.
Right.
Trustee as a person.
Yeah.
But conceivably, there are certain types of crimes that a bank, for example, could charge excessive interest and be subject to the usury laws. In this instance,
corporation.
Well, all right, but it would come within the definition of person.
Yeah.
Here, because the statute on usury would say no person shall charge greater interest than.
Yeah.
Question I have is the conditional phrase "and where appropriate," and whether or not that constitutes a constitutional problem because of not setting out any standard in the statute, and where appropriate. What about that?
Well, of course, we're talking about one word, it's...
In the word person.
Yeah. I wouldn't feel that you have a constitutional problem because it's not... we're not saying that a crime is committed where appropriate or leaving it up to some unstated standard to be the determining factor as to whether a crime has been committed.
Well, doesn't it give the court discretion, though? Now, the Model Penal Code says, and where relevant, but it seems to me the same argument applies. And maybe you're more of a constitutional lawyer than I am, Bruce. What do you...
The New York Code uses where appropriate.
And
New York Code also indicates a person may be the party whose property may be the subject of a crime. That's what my father was.
I don't know what it means, where appropriate. Where it means, what that means.
Where it can be attached.
Well, the idea is that what they're trying to do here, what New York was trying to do with this definition, was to put in one definition, not only a definition that would apply to the actor with respect to the type of person who could commit a crime, or the type of entity that could commit a crime, say, as well as providing some guidance with respect to ownership of property. I think it's a twofold definition. And the language where appropriate then would allow the court, as the Oregon court did, and I can't recall the citation of the case offhand, but it was a Douglas County case growing out of the explosion down there some years ago when the truck exploded. And there was a manslaughter indictment returned against the trucking company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this type of situation. And, of course, the Oregon court held that this corporation couldn't be held under the statute.
Well, with this
because of
language, the court would say it's not appropriate in this instance to hold them liable, huh?
Well, that's the intent, that it would allow the court to avoid weird results, but at the same time eliminate the necessity each time you set out a specific crime of saying this crime does not apply to corporations or this crime applies to natural persons only. Trying to delineate each specific crime as applying and some crimes might apply. Under certain circumstances, you might have a crime that it might be appropriate to charge a non-human person.
Let's go back to the situation of trust.
You could use the same phrase, where appropriate.
Let's go back to the situation of the Chandler Trust and assume that it has $2 million in municipal bonds or on deposit somewhere, and that it's supposed to be paid so much quarterly as interest or premiums or whatever on these bonds, and that by some manner or means in the administration of this, the trust cheats the depository, and that the crime of obtaining money by false pretenses, thank you very much, Jim, appreciate it. Crime of obtaining money by false pretenses or embezzlement or whatever says this shall be punishable by 5 years in the pen, 1 year in the county jail, or a $5,000 fine. Now, the court would have a pretty much wide open shot at whether it would be appropriate to charge that trust with the crime of OMFP or the individual, wouldn't it?
I think if you, I think it's extremely unlikely that you'd ever have that kind of a situation. Your trustee would be the one most likely to come under. I mean, somebody's going to have to, as a person, take some action in a case like that to commit the crime. I mean, the trust is as a
trust itself is not very much. The thing that bothers me is the present Oregon statute refers to the person as also being subject to the crime, whose property is subject to the crime. That was sort of my idea.
Well, that's what the ORS 161.010.11 says.
The person is both the person who the actor.
Well, where a person is or used, where a person is used to designate the property, the party whose property may be the subject of a crime. It includes the government and whatnot, private corporations, but not where they're committing the crime.
So it doesn't relate to the actor, does it?
Not always.
Not in our present, in that section, but no. aren't there sections in our present code where a corporation can be guilty of a crime? It seems to me that I've heard tell of that. I don't remember any being prosecuted lately.
Oh, I'm sure there are places where corporations would be guilty of a crime. In the corporation law,
your blue sky laws,
filing, failing to file, and so forth and so on, the income tax laws.
But we're talking when we're charged with the responsibility for the criminal code, and we're talking about basically those chapters in from 160 through 169. Are there crimes find in these chapters where a corporation would be subject or accountable to?
I don't think so, I don't think they're, of course, criminal matter, the state's the other party, so they've got no problem on the other side. They might have corporation law or taxation or someplace like that.
Yeah, well, I looked upon sub 1 as a combination of number 11 under 161.010 with respect to ownership of property in the event that we would have person used in a sense where it might come up under one of the sections. So that there wouldn't be a question that these entities could be the owner of property. And that was the intent more than saying that they could be charged with a crime. But at the same time, I recognize, at least it was my feeling in looking at the New York comments, which were very brief, unfortunately, that the at the same time, they felt that there might be instances where it might be appropriate to charge a non-human person with a crime. And I don't want to give you the wrong impression on this. I think that they were trying to do both, and I was trying to do both in adopting their approach. But
well, if I don't think there's any problem with trust, for example, charging with a crime, because I think it's something that has to be managed by people, and people have to perform the act either knowingly or negligently or some other way. There may be a problem on it as the owner of property, which is not a person under that. Anybody who steals from any person, including so forth and so on, the guy comes in and says, well, that isn't, that's a trust. It isn't a public corporation. It's a private corporation. It isn't an unincorporated association. It isn't a human being. It isn't a partnership or a government. It isn't a governmental instrumentality. And I don't know, there may be other forms of carrying on activities, although I don't think any others offhand.
Well, just scanning here, I look at the section on firearms, and it says, any person who manufactures or causes to be manufactured within this state or imports or transfers, etc., firearms shall be in violation of provisions and shall be punished upon conviction, etc.
I should think that could apply,
that
to, a
could apply to a corporation, yeah. Couldn't it?
Or a partnership.
Or a partnership.
A government instrumentality.
Right.
And bribery and treason.
Well, you could through the actor being an agent. I think we've got a policy decision to make whether we want to include corporations and unincorporated partnerships as subject to criminal proscription.
Mm-hmm, I do too.
And also whether we're referring here to both the actors and the owners of property against which some offense may be committed.
Well, I think yes. I think that should be made explicit too.
I think you ought to include corporations, partnerships, and all these things. And I don't see that the guy should be able to plead that he was acting solely as the agent of Corporation XYZ when he bribed the county clerk and the assessor in Multnomah County.
Well, of course, the agent would be himself guilty. But I think that there's some merit in getting at the corporation itself.
The sanction, the effect of the sanction would be much greater if you could get at the prime mover.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, would it be the sense of the committee then that we reflect in the commentary that it's our intent that corporations, unincorporated associations, partnerships, governmental instrumentalities be, number one, subject to the criminal proscriptions in the criminal code.
Yeah, of course. You can't put them in jail. You can't put a corporation in jail.
Well, that's right.
And so I wonder if in that we'd want to use some phrase like where the penalties are appropriate.
Well, maybe because of what you just expressed, there is a sufficient justification for the retention of these words that he put in here, right, and where appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the federal criminal penalties include fines as well as periods of imprisonment. As you go through the Title 18, if I'm not mistaken. And I guess this is something we're going to have to wrestle with when we get to
very heavy criminal damage.
Yeah, you could have a general provision that where penalty of imprisonment is not appropriate, that a certain amount of money by way of fine be equivalent to a period of imprisonment.
Right.
you know, as I point out, this comes from New York. Michigan has adopted this, but Michigan also has, under their separate article under parties to offenses, they have a section on criminal liability of corporations, and which specifically sets out under what circumstances a corporation is guilty of an offense. And this might, whether or not the commission will want to have that type of a provision in the code is another
I'm
question.
I'm looking at these California and Washington cases a couple of more than that, 4 years ago now. 4 years ago this summer when they caught the county assessors in San Francisco County and Alameda County and King County, Washington, and so forth, taking money from guys who were acting as agents for some of the biggest corporations in the country. Now, the corporations and their officers knew very well what they were doing. The only guy who went to jail was the assessor and the so-called agent who was carrying on the, who was not an employee of the corporation, who was carrying on the activity. And the Leslie Salt Company, which benefited something like $500,000 a year for 20 years out of this process, lost nothing.
Yeah, I'm for it.
Okay. All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Okay, so motion passed.
I'm also in favor of trying to do something to make the penalties against the corporation commensurate with the penalties against the individual, where the statute is heavy on imprisonment of an individual. And if it's solely a penalty of imprisonment, why, there's nothing you can do to a corporation.
Well, that's why I think we're going to have to perhaps follow the federal system, or but it's something we're going to have to wrestle with when we get to that. Certainly a $5,000 fine for the Leslie Salt Company would have been a drop in the bucket. So maybe.
Federal government, you got a criminal damages type of thing. Can't you prove the actual damage on a thing, multiply them by three in a case like this for antitrust violation?
Well, I think you do. Treble damage.
Treble damages, yeah.
Yeah, but that's to the other party. But I think in the case of a government, unit of government, the county of San Francisco could have collected.
I don't want this committee to get overloaded with journalistic or broadcasting talent, but we'll welcome Senator Statler and give him a cup of coffee if he wants one.
I'm getting out of this, and I'm selling to Bob.
No,
thank you.
Okay.
Excuse me, John.
All right, sure. Bruce, do you think that sub one sufficiently defines our intent, if it is our intent, to make the corporation, partnership, or whatever, the victim as well as the actors? You see?
Yes, I think so, because we will take care of that in the definition of crime so that it can apply to these artificial entities.
All right. Well, do we have any other, is there any further discussion then with regard to definition of person?
Can I say something?
Sure.
I haven't got the background that you have on this, but it seems to me that you brought up a good point where appropriate. That gives a broad latitude to whoever makes any decision on prosecution on this thing. Maybe too broad. Like she said, that struck. Brought up the point of how they could be prosecuted under the law and can't imprison them. But simply because they can't be imprisoned doesn't mean they shouldn't be prosecuted. And maybe, as you state, we should provide some other method of punishment and not to create a definition to meet the means that we presently have available, looking to it in the future as to what might be available in the future as far as punishment.
Well, the way we've the way we've kind of programmed this project, Doug, is that this subcommittee had an initial responsibility of going through all the crimes against property, like larceny and burglary and obtaining money by false pretense and so on, and redefining them substantively. And some other subcommittee had a responsibility for working on insanity and different things, and now we're working in general definitions. One of the things that we're going to come to next, I don't know whether it's us or whether it's another subcommittee, is going to be to attach penalties to the various types of offenses. One subcommittee will work for I don't know how many months deciding for crime of larceny. Should it be a felony, and if so, how should it be? What should their maximum term be, and so on? And I think, as Mr. Spaulding suggested, or we all discussed it, when we get to, or whatever subcommittee gets to the section on setting the penalties, I'm going to have to bear in mind that because corporations can be held accountable for the commission of crimes, we're going to have to set up penalties commensurate with the punishment of corporations. And so necessarily imprisonment won't suffice. We'll have to provide for fines, and whether we'll enact special statutes like the federal has to make the fine commensurate with the amount of damage or whatever will be decided by them. But I don't know whether I answered your question, but I agree with you. Did I?
Well, could I say just one thing? I think that really what this does, it codifies really what the law is now with respect to holding corporations to commission of a crime. Because most of our statutory crimes now are phrased in terms of any person who does such and such. And person is defined in our code now as including corporations. So corporations now are charged really where it's appropriate to charge them, or they're tried where it's appropriate to try them for certain kinds of crimes. I think that, for example, with manslaughter, manslaughter is in terms of any person who does certain act that results in the death of another, and a corporation isn't held to that because it really isn't appropriate to charge a corporation. But
would you think that when we got to the, when the subcommittee that started the work of defining the penalties, when we reached that point, would it be appropriate for it to make policy declarations as to what cases would be appropriate for a corporation to be held liable? I don't know.
By definition or by
just a statement?
By a statement.
Simple statement. That,
like, for example, homicides, for example, you know, aren't appropriate instances, aren't appropriate crimes for a corporation to be.
Well, I think conceivably they could, but they never would. They could pass a corporate resolution to bump somebody off.
Well, or, you know, we have cases on the books now where people have been charged with assault with a dangerous weapon by running people down with a car. So I'm a taxi driver and I deliberately run you down, and is the principal liable for the crime of assault with a dangerous weapon? This gets pretty esoteric.
Well, I would think there where you have to have an intent, you'd have to have a some corporate action.
The boss, the president.
The president has to have told the cab driver.
Yeah, we have authority from the corporation.
Corner of 6th and Alder tomorrow.
Yeah, wouldn't the president himself wouldn't, couldn't find the corporation unless he had authority. But you could conceivably imagine, I would think, a case
of corporate murder, yeah.
Well, would it be safe to say that that's a decision that we don't have to make at this point?
I think so. But if we're going to give them any advice, why it would seem to me that make the corporation guilty of any crime that it could or does commit.
Yeah, I would hate to get down to trying to define it too finely.
Too narrowly.
Because I think there are, most corporate crimes would come in areas like bribery and I think this makes it really almost civil crimes almost really rather than what I think of as crime, certainly not crimes of violence.
Or crimes of fraud.
Fraud, bribery, crimes against the public purpose. I guess corporations would be guilty of a lot of, some corporations would be guilty of quite a few.
Now, for example, Michigan says that a corporation's guilty if the conduct constituting the offense is engaged in by an agent of the corporation while acting within the scope of his employment and in behalf of the corporation, and the offense is a misdemeanor or a violation, or the offense is one defined by a statute that clearly indicates a legislative intent to impose such criminal liability on a corporation.
I'm looking at the aluminum siding operator. Some who are just out and out frauds. You know, it seems to me that the guy who's really responsible for their conduct is ducking behind his own company sometimes and leaving the salesman out on the limb. Now, I don't say the salesman's not guilty of a corporation, company, association, or partnership. In this case, he's got an equal responsibility.
Well, we have parallel lines of authority here because some of the consumer protection statutes more accommodate themselves toward that sort of situation. Can use have injunctive relief and close them down. You wouldn't have to prove a resolution of the board or a concerted plan of action by the corporation, I wouldn't think, but I agree that we should, wherever appropriate, be able to aim our criminal laws at corporate acts. Now, Doug, you said that you felt that the where appropriate should be stricken. Well, I had some initial question about that in the beginning, but I resolve that in favor of its of keeping it there because I think there's a sufficient need for it.
It's going to apply to two things. It's going to apply to the act or committing a crime, and apparently it's also going to attach to the property which is the subject of the crime in some cases.
Yeah, well, I,
in that case, well, I think I'm sure
there's a need for it there to make it meaningful, but I still have a bit of a question in my mind about what you raised in the first place. Is it sufficiently definite
to be
constitutional?
Is there a standard that takes it past the constitutional objection for vagueness?
American Law Institute thought it did. The New York Code Drafters thought it did. The Michigan Code Drafters thought it did. They all use the same thing. American Law Institute, the people who model penal code, any natural person, and where relevant, the corporation or unincorporated association and so forth. Michigan, where appropriate, such public or private corporation and so forth.
Who decides when it's appropriate?
Well, presumably the courts and the final analysis would decide whether or not it was appropriate.
The initial one's going to be on the part of the district attorney.
Yeah.
And then I suppose that somebody's going to, what do you do?
File
it. Part of the district attorney to guess what the judge is going to say about it, but
yeah.
Not to make the law. I mean, he couldn't, he couldn't do like a perky thing.
So then it comes to the judge as to what he's
going to say. Yeah, it's like the judge.
He's the one who has to make the decision as to whether it's appropriate or not.
I think what it really means is where it's meaningful.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you have a homicide, which carries in its penalty section first degree murder, life imprisonment. And you have somebody that kills somebody, somebody that's a corporate officer kills somebody, and the district attorney indicts a corporation for first degree murder, and the defense attorney files a demurrer, and the court says, I'm going to sustain the demurrer because the it isn't appropriate in this instance to charge this corporation with murder. It's not within the scope of the statute.
I think where it's more likely to be used is where the statute's going to stay. Any person who, with intent to defraud another of, does such and such, the district attorney looks at it and says, well, it isn't any person who in this case, it's XYZ Corporation. And so that becomes appropriate then to make it a private corporation instead of person.
Well, under Dunn's example, though, the only reason it isn't appropriate is because we don't have any penalty to apply.
Right, but that defines the legislative intent, maybe, doesn't it?
Yes, I suppose it does.
And so there's a guideline for the court to follow, and a criteria or a standard. I mean, just listening to you, when we threw it back and forth a few minutes ago, it kind of dispelled the initial doubt I had. I wish we had some help for you, Don, so that we could go through the annotations in the states that have this and see if there are any reported cases.
Well, I've checked New York. There aren't any reported cases in New York. Of course, Michigan.
I don't have enough question in my mind about the constitutional matter to object to the use of those words, and I think that it does help to me.
All right.
But when you raised it, I thought there was some validity to the question you raised.
Okay. What about the rest of the definition? Does it seem okay? Is there any other discussion about it? And if not, let's have a motion and move on to the next.
I move that we adopt it as is.
Moved and seconded that we adopt subsection 1 as drafted. All in favor, so signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Subsection 2.
That would be possess. Of course, that's going to come up particularly with respect to some of our property crimes. And all it really does is to define possession in such a way as to include constructive possession. And it's also from the New York penal law.
Do we need the word tangible in there? Does that strengthen it in? Might want to
sue somebody for defouling the air.
It might raise a lot of questions in the prosecution of whether something is tangible or intangible, where the guy be just as guilty no matter which it was.
Violating the way the 747 starts to take off over the house at the end of the runway, and instead of going the civil routes, you want to bring a criminal charge against Boeing and United.
You mean for possessing the air overhead?
Befouling it.
Well, how does that relate to possess?
it relates to tangible. I think you've got a right of possession, don't you?
Well, my only thought is to get
argument
about whether property is tangible or intangible. It might be the subject of a crime. And I would think that you don't need tangible.
Well, I would think that with the more and more sophisticated types of the transactions that we have, which are subject to the, or possibly subject to the OMFP laws, that a person could be in possession of intangibles without being physically in possession. What about that, Don?
Well, I think that it's conceivable that you can have a situation where you might want, not want it limited. My feeling was that based on our theft draft and everything, that this would be the instances where it would most likely apply, but I don't think it'd do any violence to the definition to take tangible out of there.
Okay, let's look at the section on receiving, concealing stolen property. And did we define possess there?
Well,
we did not.
Defined property and started with the theft tenants act number one.
Theft by receiving.
Where is that?
On page 14 of tentative draft number one. It's under your first pink tab in your book.
Oh, these are the ones that have been adopted by the commission.
Yeah. Receiving means acquiring possession, control, or title, or landing on the security of the property.
Which page?
That's 14. Page 14.
Well, where so far in the code have we used possessed on?
Well, actually, we've used possession. Ordinarily, in most places, we've used the noun form.
Where is it contemplated that we're going to use this then?
Well,
Bob, would you like to take
okay,
it
under, right well, for example,
okay. Maybe if it's okay, we'll take
under, a... For example, possession of burglar's tools, we use possess.
Well, now, didn't we define it right there?
No, we defined burglar tool, but we didn't define possess.
Where is that? What page?
That's page 13 of Kennedy draft number one of burglary.
Possession of them. Dangerous guns.
All right.
If he possesses any burglar tool with intent to use the tool, etc.
13 of what?
Of the draft done on burglary and criminal trespass, which is the fourth tab.
Why would it be appropriate to have possess in the general definitions where so far we've only used it in this section on possession of burglar's tools when we have receiving, when we do not have receiving here, and we have receiving defined in the specific section as it relates to receiving stolen property?
Well, of course, all of our, as I mentioned early in the commentary there, it, trying to draft these definitions is a little bit of a chicken or the egg type of problem, that without having all the specific sections drafted on crimes, we're not positive that any one of these definitions might be required. I mean, I think it's going to be.
Where? Where's it going to be required?
Well, possession of possession of narcotics, for example. Possession of an instrument of a crime. Or, there's possibility that there will be other sections other than the ones we've used, so that the draftsman should have some guidance as to what we're talking about when we use possess.
Was there an overriding public policy, or is there an overriding or a sufficiently overriding necessity to include it within the general definitions? And not some other things that may be used as much, as opposed to just...
Well, I think to this extent, I think that we should make it clear that we mean possession that is not limited to actual possession, and that this encompasses constructive possession of property as well. I mean, it's overriding from that standpoint.
We think about it for 5 minutes and let take a break so we can get Bob Chandler in on it. And I'll clean up an argument. Yeah.